This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Daniel Hornsby's novel, Via Negativa, takes readers on a journey across the Midwest with Father Dan, the narrator of the book. Along the way, Father Dan picks up a wounded coyote and tries to nurse it back to health in the back of his Toyota Camry. The premise sounds simple enough, but Hornsby weaves into the story medieval texts, current scandals, and perhaps most complicated of all, faith. I recently spoke with Hornsby about Via Negativa. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. I think it's on page 44 when we first see the mention of Via Negativa. Would you mind defining that phrase or that tradition for the listener?
Sure. So the Via Negativa is kind of a loose theological tradition taken from a couple, sources in Christian history. It refers to a way of thinking about the divine, not in terms of like images or words, kind of in the positive mode, but in the negative. So like what God isn't. So a couple examples, there's this guy named Pseudo-Dionysius who has this book on mystical theology and talks about like a God that's kind of beyond words, a God that is beyond kind of what you can picture in your mind. Another really good example would be like the Cloud of Unknowing, which is this medieval text, kind of a guide for imageless prayer. So like a Christian kind of version maybe of something like mindfulness. Yeah, so the Via Negativa really refers to this negative way, this negative road for approaching, the infinite, ultimately.
And so to hear you describe that, you would think that this, that's not what this book is about. So maybe we could give an elevator speech of exactly, what this novel is about.
Maybe the term Via Negativa is a good way in on that, right? Because, like a via, like the Via of St. James, the road for pilgrims, it kind of plays with that. So, it is a road novel. It follows this priest who, for reasons you kind of learn later on, is kicked out of his rectory and is living out of his Toyota Camry on a road trip to see some former parishioners, or at least he tells you, to see some former parishioners in Seattle. And on the way, he picks up this wounded coyote and tries to heal it in his car. And he runs into a bunch of different characters. That's a loose outline, but I think you get the sense from there.
I tried to do a little bit of research on you to better understand how you are so well-versed in the Catholic faith, and I didn't find much on you, except you did receive a Master of Theological Studies from Harvard Divinity School. So what is your relationship with religion?
Yeah, so I grew up in Muncie, Indiana, which is one of the kind of, settings in the book in a way. Father Dan spent most of his priestly career in Muncie at a parish that I made up called St. Anthony's. So I grew up in the real Muncie, and I went to a pretty conservative Catholic school from really preschool through the eighth grade. And so I think in maybe as a way to kind of navigate, like, because it was a smaller Catholic population there than in a city like Cincinnati or Detroit or something. And so I think that kind of was like kind of a crucible that made it even more orthodox in some ways, because there wasn't as much of a variety of expression of being Catholic there. So I got a lot of that stuff pretty early. And then later on in life, I went to Kansas State for my undergrad. So I lived in Manhattan, Kansas, not too far from you guys, and then did an MFA. And I found myself writing more and more about characters who were really dealing with spiritual ideas and religious history. So I realized the kind of tradition there is so old and there is so much text that I wanted a little more than like the kind of Wikipedia facility with some of these ideas. And so a religious studies degree made sense for me. It helped me kind of navigate this really big archive, this really big body of text to figure out, where are the weird characters there? What are the weird ideas at play in the margins of the history of Christian thought and practice? And so a lot of the book kind of comes out of that. I took a course with Stephanie Paulsell, who is a brilliant religious thinker, about Christian contemplative prayer traditions, and we read The Way of a Pilgrim, the text from 19th century Russia, this pilgrimage text. And I became kind of obsessed with the idea of, like, how could I make a pilgrimage road novel in America today, but still layer in a lot of this kind of deeper, like, pilgrim history, so to speak. Yeah, and so the book was kind of a natural outpouring of that research and study.
Well, one of the reasons I asked is because, you know, the insight you seem to have into the priesthood, it seemed kind of, well, I'm not a priest, but it seemed to me pretty spot on, you know, especially when you were outlining some of their frustrations that they might feel. Like, you were asked to do a baptism, but not be a godfather. You officiate a wedding, but you're never a groomsman. Yeah, right. So you're in the middle of things, but you're always an outsider. So I was wondering just if you had any friends who were priests who were able to help you with some of that insight or perspective?
A lot of that came from observation. Priest, family, friends, you know, being around a lot of priests as a kid and seeing the ways in which they both were at the center and the outside of these big life events. You know, you go to a wedding and the priest maybe offered some, you know, counseling to the bride and groom and does all of the magic of the ceremony, and then you see him at a table by himself. I mean, you know, there aren't any women priests, sadly. By himself, just sitting there. And so those kinds of images, I think, stuck with me. And I kind of put together a lot of that interiority myself. And I think that's a big issue with the priesthood, that, you know, people with these religious vocations, especially within the Catholic Church, where you're giving up the kind of monogamous partnership that, you know, is one of the big cultural norms in America. So you're opting out of a lot of things, but yet you're a part of a community and you have a lot of power and accountability. And that's an interesting little kind of paradoxical relationship to have with, you know, your parish, that you're at the center and you're at the outside, I guess is how I'll put it. I know I said that already.
So one thing I wanted to ask you, because, you know, I didn't really find a lot of information from you online. I think I saw where you might have graduated. I couldn't really tell from what school it was in 2008. So you're a young man, yet you're writing from a perspective of a 70-year-old or of a priest in his 70s. Is that right? Was he about in
yeah.
his 70s? So how were you able
to... Yeah, just 70 on the nose, exactly.
Yeah, how were you able to write from that perspective, not having lived that many years yourself?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that one of the fun things, one of the real pleasures of writing fiction is imagining the kind of, you know, interior decoration and upholstery of a fully lived life of a person, right? So that, even though it was kind of daunting at times, that was where a lot of the pleasure of writing the book came from. I could imagine trips he took, like to Israel, or weird projects, or strange detours in his life. I could imagine friends for him, think about the pain of those relationships. And, you know, if he was a 40-year-old priest, there'd just be a lot less material. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of priests that age. You know, if you look at some of the diocesan math, the falling off of, you know, the number of young priests is pretty tremendous. And so someone like Dan is really a witness to different waves and trends in Christian and spiritual life in America, as well as just life in America. So that means some of the Second Vatican Council stuff. That means the backlash to that. That means the sex abuse crisis and the gradual illumination of that, especially, you know, I think with the, you know, the reporting that came out in the year 2000. So one of my tricks for that was giving him my name. And I felt like, okay, I've established this link. It just made more sense if I just really put myself in his position and tried to speak in a kind of essayistic or sermon-like way from his point of view. And then that placeholder really just stuck and it kind of worked texturally. I feel like there's a 1 out of 4 chance an Irish Catholic or priest is named Dan or Mike, maybe a Tim or a Brian. But it's just that those are the odds, and it just stuck as a kind of texture and made sense kind of historically.
So one thing that fascinated me, you write that there used to be 8 deadly sins and that there still should be. Talk to me about the 8th deadly sin.
Sure. So this is one of the kind of demons that Father Dan battles in my book. So the guy who's kind of responsible for giving us the deadly sins, he's this dude named Evagrius of Pontus, who was a kind of up-and-coming Roman official living in what's now Turkey, who got embroiled in a scandal. And, you know, back in these times, the opening centuries of Christianity, a lot of these monasteries and communities in Lower Egypt where the Desert Fathers and the kind of earliest expressions of monasticism happen, a lot of them were financed by these wealthy Roman widows. And so, you know, we have a couple Melanias actually come out of that. 2 particularly famous Melanias finance a lot of these communities, you know, hundreds of miles away. And so one of these widows tells Evagrius, like, okay, just go to Lower Egypt, just live out a life there, I'll finance this for you. And so he goes down there, and he's somebody who, you know, coming out of more cosmopolitan existence, really like does battle with these sins. He really feels them quite acutely and catalogs them. And the first 7 everybody knows, you know, from like the Brad Pitt movie with, you know, Morgan Freeman or whatever. But the 8th one, Akedia, it's called the Noonday Demon by some. And it is really particular to monks, and so it doesn't get included quite as much. But it is this kind of feeling of listlessness. So John Cashion, in his Institutes, he describes it as like, you know, you've done your morning prayer. You've done the kind of, you used up that first wave of energy in the day. And then you kind of get up from sitting and you go to your window or you go to your door and you think about all the roads not taken. You think about like disagreements and arguments of the past, and you despair at how your life has no spiritual fruit. I think is how he puts it, loosely, obviously. And yet, like, that's a demon that I think we all kind of deal with, especially for those of us maybe working from home or just in isolation right now. I know for a fact that artists and writers deal with it, right? Like, you've had your coffee, you put in a couple hours of work, and then you get up and you're like, what am I doing? So that one really torments Dan, and it's a way in for me to think about, you know, regret and pain in his life.
So your character believes that the holiest people are the ones who can leave everything behind in search of a true life. And he lists some heavy hitters in the church, as well as the prairie wizards and a hitchhiker. So talk to me about this idea.
Yeah, so the prairie wizards, you know, I went to school in Manhattan, Kansas, which your listeners are going to be familiar with. Some other people I've talked to, I have to explain that it's not Manhattan. But I had a good friend there whose name is Brent. He lives in Salina now, actually. And he's, you know, an illustrator, works for the Topps Trading Card Company. And he has all of these great stories about growing up in Salina and told me about how his dad pointed out some of the like Vietnam vets who have lived this kind of peripatetic existence that they would see as kids. And, you know, they'd have dogs and they'd kind of live off the land and hunt and stuff like that. And his dad called them prairie wizards. And he and his twin brother, I think, thought they might actually be in possession of some magical power. So I wanted to put them in there because, you know, these are people who kind of live on the margins of society. And they're very similar to the Desert Fathers in some ways. And I know a lot of that comes from just our inability to take care of, you know, veterans and provide lasting support for them. But these people are fascinating, and there is some spiritual dimension to that existence that me and my narrator, I think, really find captivating. And so I wanted to include them. And there's, you know, hitchhikers, and you think about even like, you know, teenage runaways. I think there's something really moving about the courage it takes to live out there and jump out of the kind of comfortable society that, you know, makes us complicit with a lot of evil in the world.
So many of your descriptions were just spot on. And one I'm thinking of is the description of the coins in the tar pit of the coffee spills of a cup holder. I could go down to my car and look at that right now. And you mentioned earlier that you were able to write about priests because of observation. So I'm wondering how much of your writing is observation? How were you able to get some of these descriptions just so spot on?
Yeah, that's really fun for me. I really take a lot of delight in trying to figure out a good metaphor or simile. And I feel like sometimes just the attention to those kinds of tiny details can be spiritual. I don't know if that sounds a little too woo-woo for your listeners. But like, what does the dicky muck at the bottom of a cup holder in your neon look like, you know? And giving that quality of attention to that can unlock some non-cliched, very tiny truths that I think sometimes can add up and really help create a full portrait of a person. You know, I've worked a good deal in food service. I've been a waiter and a bartender. I think that, like, you know, if I had to give advice for maybe writers a little younger than me, there's nothing better than a good food service job, because not only are you constantly exposed to a lot of different people making it work in that industry, whether that's, you know, people working in the kitchen with you, people working on the floor, people of different ages kind of working together, but also just the way people talk, you know, your customers, because you're given a kind of degree of invisibility and you can really eavesdrop quite a bit and extract some very good dialogue that way, find some good characters that way. I had regulars at the bar I used to work at. One had worked in cryptography for the Navy and would like help locate, you know, Russian subs. Another was on a submarine for most of his 20s, a submarine the size of a football field. Another person I met at that job suited up every day and cleaned the tanks of the hippos at the zoo. You know, if you work a job like that, those people come to you and they'll tell you their stories. And that's all fair game, I think.
Well, you know, you mentioned that you lived in Manhattan, and one of the scenes in your book takes place in Manhattan, Kansas. And I was, you described the bar very, very vividly, but I was trying to place it. Is that an actual bar, or was that part of your, did you make that up?
It's a little homage to a bar called Auntie May's, where I played in a band in college, and I went there all the time. They had a poetry night that was really formative for me. The owner, Jeff Denny, is just like an upstanding Manhattan, Kansas citizen, and has really sustained a lot of the cultural life there. So shout out to him. And it's just a wonderful institution. I mix some things around. I gave it a different owner, but the layout is mostly the same. Like in my mind, it's Annie Mae's, but like recast, you know, the bar is playing a different bar, if that makes sense.
Well, I didn't realize the Kansas State connection until I read your acknowledgments. And and when we chose this book for our literary feast, we didn't realize there was a Kansas connection at all. Didn't realize that. It came recommended from a friend at Random House who said, "This is a favorite, and I think you would really like it."
That boggles the mind.
Well, so you know, you traveled all across the state, and because it makes sense now that you went to Kansas State and that you were familiar with a lot of these places. And I had no idea it was going to spend so much time right here in Kansas. And I think maybe when our listeners read it, they'll think, oh, they did this on purpose. But it'll be okay. If they're listening now, they'll find out. We had no idea.
Yeah. So I went to Kansas State. So I was there for 4 years in Kansas. And then my family lived in Manhattan as well, and was there a little bit longer. Now, everyone in my immediate family lives in Kansas City on the Missouri side, but just like 2 miles in. But they were there for a while, and my sister went to Kansas State. My brother went to KU.
Oh.
But Kansas gets a really bad rep just from some of the political stuff that goes down, but I have a lot of affection for the state. Honestly, it's very close to my heart, and my closest friends are, you know, from Oskaloosa and Ellsworth and Kannapolis.
Okay.
Bogue as well, if you're familiar, and Salina too.
When did you move from Indiana to Kansas then?
Yeah, so when I was 19, my dad got a job at Kansas State, and I got a pretty good scholarship offer there. And so our whole family made this little exodus from Muncie to Manhattan, Kansas.
Okay.
And Kansas is really, it's really perfect for my purposes, not just for my affection for it, but, you know, it's at the heart of the country.
Right.
And there are, you know, you have the concrete prairie dog, you have Coronado's Castle.
Yeah.
You've got a bunch of these kind of, you know, American pilgrimage sites, or at least trying to be.
Yeah.
And so it works for me in this kind of spiritual way as well. And I think it's a beautiful landscape. I love the Flint Hills. I think they're gorgeous. And the parts that people, you know, like to insult, I actually think are really pretty. And I've met some of my closest and best friends there, and I know their families. And, you know, I've been able to kind of get a nice little taste of the central and western side of the state too.
So the paintball, is that a real thing?
Yeah, that one I took that from another location. I just really like, so for the listeners, you know, there's this giant ball of paint that the narrator visits at one point. And I think what's really cool about them, so for me, if something is really, if I think it's really beautiful or captivating, I want to kind of cantilever that with some humor or something kind of gross. You know, I think that if we think about like relics from saints, right, they're supposedly they have this kind of, you know, tremendous spiritual power. But if you actually go and see them, like Catherine of Siena's head, it's withered and it's kind of gross. Like you go and then it's this beautiful, kind of looks like a monster, and says these golden rays made out of metal to house this like little shriveled head. And to think that like the divine can be entered with like these, like with the toe or a withered finger as the key, is kind of cool. And so the ball of paint for me, I think, is just this kind of beautiful image where, you know, it's just made up of all of these people passing through, adding another layer and another layer, you know, imperceptibly thin layers until you have this giant thing. And I think life is kind of like that, as corny as that sounds. It's just every day there's this new layer. And eventually you have this strange, amorphous, but hopefully colorful and beautiful thing as a result that people can look at and find some peculiar beauty in.
Well, then Father Dan was able to treat some other things as if they were relics. I mean, a letter and maybe not the, I don't think the ukulele string made it into the bag, but he sealed them up so they were incorruptible. And those were a different type of relic for him, weren't they?
They were, yeah. There are a lot of kind of personal relics. The Camry becomes his own little reliquary. And I like these objects. So for Dan, you know, he's obsessed with the via negativa, you know, the way of denial. And he's also in denial of a lot of, you know, some very traumatic things that have happened to him and his, especially one of his closest friends. And so these objects for me were a way to kind of show the reader and also just kind of access some of Dan's pain and show that there's something there. If you stick around, I'll show you what they are. And they're reminders for him who, you know, he's somebody who has really used the office of the priesthood as a way to, you know, he can always just jump ship. And while I find that kind of, you know, I find opting out of kind of the mainstream culture really powerful, sometimes we're called to be there for people and be, you know, emotionally present. And he's avoided that. And so the objects are ways, they're little amulets to kind of like return us to the center of things and work around his denial.
Well, you mentioned some of the negative things, and Via Negativa does touch on some negative parts of the church. It looks at the sexual abuse.
Certainly.
It looks at the sexual abuse that was overlooked by those who should have protected the innocents. And this pilgrimage was a journey of atonement in a way. I know Catholics think that they have the market cornered on guilt, but what more do you think should be done in this regard with the church and the scandal? And
that's a really hard question. And it's, you know, there's so many people who have had, who've experienced tremendous pain. And, you know, it's like my parents, you know, knew victims of, you know, sexual abuse at the hands of priests in their community when they were growing up. And I did a lot of research just to make sure I could kind of do some justice to that experience, just reading accounts of people who've gone through this terrible thing. I don't really know. I think that just acknowledging and being honest is the first step. Like, there's no truth and reconciliation without truth. And just acknowledging the tremendous pain that's been inflicted on these people and the pain that comes with the silence that follows, you know, sometimes decades long, is a start. But I, you know, reconciliation, I think, is really on my mind a lot, you know, in this country that's like so broken and has subjected so many people to so much pain. And I think really acknowledging that is a first step, and then listening to the victims and making sure that their stories are told, you know, that's part of it. And from there, I think if we can all acknowledge it, then maybe a path forward can emerge. You know, reconciliation, you don't get your sins forgiven if you don't say your sins, right?
Right. You know, I will not say anything about the ending other than, oh my word, what an ending. Okay. Loved the ending. Loved it.
Well, thank you.
I shut that book with a smile on my face. I'm like, oh,
well, thank you.
And okay, so
thank you. That means the world to me, honestly. That's like, it really does. It warms my heart because, you know, you work on these things forever.
How long did you work on this book?
Well, I mean, I've thrown away a couple manuscripts, and so it cannibalized some other things I'd worked on. And it's also blurry because it's like, when did I start it? But a couple of years, you know,
yeah,
for sure.
Okay, we've talked about a lot, but do you have anything that you want to add that I didn't ask or didn't think to ask?
I mean, I think one thing that I'm really interested in would be like the kind of secret histories of people kind of on the margins of certain traditions. And so, I mean, I think people in Kansas know this, that like a lot of very radical, very loud voices religiously get kind of put on the national stage, right? But there are a lot of quieter, more subtle avenues where a lot of people are exploring things in a quieter way. And, you know, there are people all throughout kind of Christian history that have really worked with a lot of what I kind of think of as spiritual creativity. You know, there were women in the Middle Ages called Beguines who would kind of opt out of, like, you know, they would kind of go on these kind of almost like prolonged retreats where they would live together in community and engage in these kinds of intense forms of scriptural study. And Meister Eckhart, who's pretty popular, he, you know, preached to these communities. There were a lot of people who would become saints who preached to them. You think about people like Dominic or St. Francis, you know, they created kind of new innovative ways of engaging with religious life. But a lot of these stories, they get kind of pushed to the margins in favor of a narrative that's really convenient for the moment. Yeah, and so it's one of those things where I'm always kind of thinking about, like, those people who really step outside of the narratives that have been thrust upon them. Teresa of Avila is one. I mean, she's a doctor of the church, and she's very popular. But you have to think, to be, you know, a woman at that time writing, that alone is revolutionary and very transgressive. And I'm inspired by people like her.
That was Daniel Hornsby, author of the book Via Negativa, which was published by Knopf. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at kmuw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider giving us a favorable rating or review. And join us next time as I visit with M.O. Walsh, author of The Big Door Prize. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.